This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Donald Davis was born and raised in Waynesville, North Carolina. His roots in Haywood County go back to the 1700s on both sides of his family. His dad was born in 1901 and was the eighth of 13 children. Donald's mother was the oldest of nine children, so he had lots of aunts and uncles and cousins. And the fact that his mother was 18 years younger than his father meant that his extended family spanned a big patch of time. Donald spent his childhood listening to his relatives tell stories. Retelling them at school made him something of a classroom celebrity, so it seemed that Donald's fate as a storyteller was sealed. But first, there was a career as a Methodist minister. Donald Davis has been a professional storyteller for more than a decade. He lives on Ocracoke Island. He travels the country, headlining festivals and teaching workshops. He's gathered some of his beloved tales from his years growing up in Western North Carolina in a new book called Stories from a Free-Range Childhood. And Donald Davis is my guest on the program today. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Oh,
good to have you here.
Thank you.
We had you on a few years back telling stories about Thanksgiving
right.
for a holiday show.
Right.
And now we really want to find out more about you and who did you listen to? Who were telling stories to you the first
well,
time?
Well, we would go on Sunday afternoons or Saturday afternoons to visit the relatives, and they were scattered all over Haywood County. My mother once figured that the average Sunday dinner was about 35 people, wherever we ended up. And my favorite thing was to sort of hide out in the corner or even under the table or under the porch in the summertime and do what I called listen to the old people talk. And I had no idea it was called storytelling. The word story had sort of become a bad word. It was a word that denoted lying, something you shouldn't do. So I had no idea that that story was this rich, rich sharing of, let me tell you what I did this week, who I saw, remember that time when. And I just loved it. I can remember doing this as early as about second grade, go back to school and tell kids something I'd heard, either at Uncle Frank's house, my grandmother's house, Aunt Esther's house, Uncle Grover's house. And pretty soon on Mondays, they would say, where did you go this time? What did you hear this time? And I was a little kid. So I was not really into, rough play. And the watching and the retelling just suited me fine.
So this is the way
I fit right in there.
Yeah, you can distinguish yourself somehow
exactly.
On the campus.
Yes.
Pretty cool. Were you able, you said something just a second ago that I found interesting. They were telling stories about the way things were back then, but also what happened last week. Those are two different kinds of stories, aren't they?
Yeah, it was very interesting to look back and begin to discern a watershed. There was a watershed between the things that you heard once. And when you heard it, you knew that was the only time you'd hear it. And the things which, when you heard them the first time, you knew that's going to come back again. That's going to come back again. And that second sort of story would grow and expand and sort of find its place in the canon of family stories. And what I finally realized, the difference was the kind of thing that was told once was sort of a report that something happened. But the kind of thing that kept coming back was something that happened from which some kind of learning occurred. Mm. So some sort of progress was made just by the fact of living through it, which made that story be retold and retold and retold, almost so that maybe other people wouldn't necessarily have to live through the same thing to get out on the other side of it.
Did you have that sense early on, and I don't mean to that level of articulation, but that categorically one story was going to sell better in the classroom than another?
I very much had that sense. I think then my sense would have been the difference was a fragment versus a story, but when I really think about it later, it wasn't that the first thing was fragmentary. It was just of no permanent retelling value.
Wasn't going to have enough. Now, you call your book Tales of a Free-Range Childhood.
Yes.
Tell us why. What is that? What do you mean
well,
by that?
Well, People operate under the illusion that the world is very dangerous today. The reality is the world was much more dangerous then. It's a lot safer now than it was then. But the news makes us feel like things that happen on the other side of the world might happen right next to us any moment. And so we sort of operate with this isolate children from the world kind of fear. But we totally ran loose. We were completely loose. And out of that, came the creation of play, the creation of meaning, the creation of adventure that really led to all kinds of learning that doesn't come from taking a class. It just comes from blundering into something and then figuring out how to get yourself out of it on the other end.
Yeah, but you know, you put your finger on something fairly interesting there, the idea that there's, again, different kinds of storytelling. If you're growing up in a world where the stories from the great beyond don't get to you very quickly, mm-hmm. and they don't feel as intimate as they do with the 24/7 news cycle, then you're living in a world where a bunch of survivors have told you stories. So however horrific they've seen, the lesson is, well, I guess you can get through this.
Well, and the sense also was that we own stories. We have stories. Stories are not just what you see in a movie or reading a book or watch on television. No, we have more stories than that. And besides that, they're our stories. And I think there was a real sense of the value of those stories from early childhood.
Is that, do you think that may be why, if you're right, if you're right that we're feeling more like we live in a more dangerous world today, your sense is no, it wasn't. It wasn't just as much then. The sense of ownership over the kind of stories we got versus what you see on...
It may be, because I meet kids in high school who have never heard a story from their own parents' childhood. Or who know their old grandparents but have never heard them tell about anything that they did, because their whole focus is on what's on, you know, what's on TV right now, what electronic game are we playing with, and are we going to the mall? So it's a very different kind of soaking in family.
Your dad was a banker, mom mm-hmm. a school teacher. You have a brother named Joe. Had a brother. Now I wonder how typical your childhood was in Waynesville.
For that time and place, I think it was fairly typical. Until I say that, and then the moment I say it, I realize no, it was not. My best friend David Morgan was an orphan whose mother had died when he was 3 years old, and who was raised by his grandmother, who pretty much said, "I'll see you when you get home." And anytime we wanted to get away with something, we gravitate over to David's house because his grandmother set us free. My other best friend, Bill, was also an orphan. He had neither parent and lived with his older half-sister. And so I realized as soon as I think that life was typical, that the kids around me came out of all kinds of different circumstances. But I think my mother thought she was everybody's mother. And so that partly pulled us together.
And you at one point decided to become your brother's barber.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about Joe's haircut.
when Joe was born, he looked like my father. They both had very curly, dark hair. And my mother and I looked alike, and she called our hair little mouse hair. And as soon as my little brother was born with this curly hair, my mother immediately labeled it naturally curly, wasted on a boy. And she just lamented that she didn't get naturally curly hair. She loved his hair so much that she wouldn't cut it when he was a baby. She just let it get longer and longer. And that became sort of a habit and a pattern. And it went on and on and on till he really was sort of a little Shirley Temple running around. I would get so embarrassed when we go to town because people would come up and say, "Oh, what a beautiful little girl you have. Oh, look, isn't she darling?" And it was just embarrassed me to death. Well, when the summer before he was going to go off to school, the relatives kept sort of pressing her, "Aren't you going to cut his hair before he goes to school?" And so I began to realize this is an issue. My daddy's hobby was annoying my mother. And one of his ways that summer was taking some old hand hair clippers, which you could carry with you anywhere because they didn't need to be plugged in, mm-hmm. and he would chase my brother. And my mother would break it up and say, "I'm going to cut his hair, but don't you touch him." And I thought, well, they're not talking about me. You know, she's talking about my daddy not touching him. So one day we were playing in the woods. We had a little sort of rubber Mickey Mouse character hats, and it was a very hot day, and my little brother pulled his hat off and said, "It's making my head wet and it stinks." And I just told him, "It's because you need a haircut." And he said, "Well, where do you get one?" Because he'd never had one. And I said, "Stay right here. I'll be back." So I got the clippers from the house, and I remember looking at him and seeing these long curls and innately knowing that if I do this, I'm going to be in very bad trouble, but immediately thinking, I'm going to do it anyway. I thought about our grandfather who had very white hair, but we always wondered why his hair had kind of slid off the top of his head because it just bunched up around the edges. And when I saw my little brother holding the Mickey Mouse cap, I thought, I can cut his hair like my grandfather's hair because he can put the cap over that part. And he'll have plenty of curls to still hang down. So I really thought my mother would never know I did it because I was 8 years old. So I turned him into what looked like a five-year-old Benjamin Franklin. And we went back in the house later with our hats on, and my mother immediately said, "We don't wear hats at the supper table." And when his hat came off, oh, my goodness, it was quite a scene. In the end, she got very mad at my father because he thought what we'd done was funny.
Oh,
yeah. She said, "It's not funny. You cut his precious hair, his precious hair. He has to be punished." And my dad took me out in the yard and sat me in a chair. And then he gave the clippers to my brother and let him cut my hair any way he wanted to.
There you go.
So,
turnabout is fair play.
Yeah, eventually, 2 days later, the barber shaved our heads.
Talking to storyteller Donald Davis, our conversation on the state of things will continue in a moment. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with professional storyteller Donald Davis. His new book is called Tales from a Free-Range Childhood. I want to stay with his family and childhood for a moment. Was there anyone, you know, most of your, it sounds like you are surrounded by storytellers. Anybody who wasn't the kind of shy, silent type among your family?
Well, there were different people who were sort of called on to tell the story. Mm. My Uncle Frank was a person people loved to hear the way Uncle Frank told it. So they might all know the story, but they would say, "Frank, you tell about, you know, the time when you did so and so." Though anyone there could have done that, it was much interesting when he did it. Uncle Frank used to say, "You know, unless it takes longer to tell the story than it took for it to happen, it's not really a good story." And I think from him, probably I absorbed a lot of things about expansion and elaboration, which is not fabrication, but simply, you know, elaboration. There were people who were very shy, but in a conversation, you could pull the same kind of thing from them.
Well, one of the reasons I ask is that I suppose for a good storyteller, what you need are listeners, somebody mm-hmm. who's going to be in that crowd and want to hear the story, right?
Yeah. Yes. And one of the things in a family like that is people get accustomed to all talking at the same time or they never get a chance to talk. Right. Maybe I was the listener there a while.
Well, and that's the other side of it. To be a good storyteller, you have to be a listener, don't you?
Absolutely. I always learn more listening than I do when I'm telling. When I'm performing at a festival, the best thing there is to be able to listen to the other tellers, especially if I'm getting them to hear stories I've heard them tell before, to see how are they handling it this time? How are they negotiating with this audience? Because you're always negotiating with an audience. You're sort of throwing a rope out and getting them to grab the other end of it and pull their end up tight while you pull your end up tight, and you're walking the story back and forth on that rope between you. And every audience is different. So when I can watch one of my friends tell a story I've heard them tell many times with a completely new audience and say, "Now, how are they going to make this turn? How is this going to happen?" That's when I really learn. And it all does come out of the listening. It's not something you can just practice on your own.
Can you learn that subtle art of working with the audience by listening? It seems to me that so much of that would be some kind of immeasurable feel that you have with the audience. Are they with me here? Do I have to pull them in?
A lot of it is. A lot of it is innate difference. But when I think about it this way, some kids somehow on their own just learn to read before they ever go to school. Some learn with great difficulty. But we try to teach all of them. You know, we try to say, if we work at this, no matter where you started, you can get better. And it's the same way with oral communication. Some people are innately better than others. But if you work on it, everybody can come forward from where they started.
Though there is, you know, you talked about Uncle Frank's idea that elaboration is going to be an important part of the story. Some people got it and some people ain't.
Right.
Would you say? I mean, they elaborate
right.
the wrong parts.
Oh,
there's too much dialogue. Yep. You think, when's this going to end?
Yep. And that's when you have to be able to watch the listeners. Because the listeners are the cue givers. They're talking back to me with their whole body, with their eyes and their face. They're talking back with sound, with that kind of silence that denotes total attention, and that kind of noisy silence that's inattention. And then laughter that doesn't say that's funny, but says, I see it. Mm. You know, every laugh says, I know her, I've been there, I've done that. And if I'm a writer, even if I rewrite something 100 times, there's still only one person working on it. But if I'm telling it with a real focus on the listeners, all those people are helping me say, that's enough. That's too much. That's not quite enough, because their faces either go, huh, or aha, or oh-ho-ho-ho, and I have to really be bouncing off that. That's why scripting is very dangerous, because the timing isn't there that you have to pick up when you're working with real-life people.
But it's an interesting place to be in terms of what's going on in your mind, if I may. You on the one hand, have to be focused on a story.
Mm-hmm.
And is it pictures in your mind you're describing?
It's pictures. It's all pictures. It's not words.
You're not
it's
words,
like
right?
I'm taking you through a series of scenes.
Yeah.
And if the story works later on, you don't even have an awareness of the words. You have an awareness of having watched the story.
And there you are describing the story as it passes by. So meticulous attention to that and also that world in front of you.
Exactly.
Paying strict attention to both things at the same time.
And it's a juggling kind of thing that goes on all the time. It's great fun.
Very cool thing. Now, a lot of your stories in this book, in fact, all of them, Tales from a Free-Range Childhood, are about your childhood, not from your adult life. You have some theories about how long a story has to marinate, in a way, before you really feel ready to tell it.
Well, my sense is you have to know what progress was made by living through an event before it moves from simply being a report of what happened to being a story. Today, we can make a report on what happened yesterday, but we don't understand the meaning of what happened yesterday, often for a good bit of time. And that once that meaning step comes into focus, then we know what the story is, not just what the report was. So some of those things take years after it happened. Some things come quickly. Often when you get home from a trip, you can tell the story of the trip because you understand it. It's over now. But when you're working through a whole lifetime, often years pass before the significance even of a relationship or an inversion event really comes to its conclusion.
An inversion event, meaning?
Well, it's that kind of day. When we get up in the morning, we kind of think we know what's going to happen during the day. And as the day goes along, if what we think was going to happen is really what happens, there's no story. And we get home and Mama says, what happened at school today? And the answer is nothing, because if what we expected is what happened, that equals nothing. But we also have those days when we think we knew what was going to happen and something comes around the corner and it turns the day upside down. And that's an inversion. And the inversion doesn't have to be negative. It can be a positive inversion. You know, getting married is an inversion. Moving into a new house is an inversion. You know, they're not negative things, but a tornado is an inversion, like yesterday. So anytime a day gets turned upside down, there's really a potential story hiding under that day.
And that's what we do, isn't it? We take that inversion, that upending,
yes,
and try to find some meaning in that. What
try
was
to find find the meaning in it. We try to then crawl out from under it. And by the time we can crawl back on top of it, we say, okay, who learned something by living through that, and what did they learn? And occasionally, it's the listener who learns.
So we're not particularly surprised then to learn that a professional storyteller may have started out as a minister, as you did.
Well, the interesting thing is the storytelling sandwiched that career, because I grew up with all these family stories on and on and on and on. I went off to seminary and came out and headed out to my first church preaching the way I was taught in seminary, which is basically how to write a sermon so someone could put a grade on it, and then watching people go to sleep. And the same people would go to sleep in the same order each week, and it was predictable. Five men would go to sleep before the first woman was asleep, you know? But I could knock all of them out in a little while. But at the same time, someone would ask me to come give a program, say, at the Lions Club or the Kiwanis Club, and I would just tell a story, and no one went to sleep, and they also wanted to know if I could tell another story so they wouldn't have to go back to work after lunch. And I finally figured out that that's what I needed to be doing in church as well, so I began to work with parable, which is the parallel story, you know, parallel stories. And then people stayed awake and things began to grow and move forward in all kinds of ways.
And that's really what good preaching's about, isn't it?
It's really finding the meaning.
If it works. And even when you talk about an audience giving a knowing glance or a knowing laugh, that moment in your story, the story of Joe's haircut, where you talk about knowing that you're going to get in trouble, but you have to do it anyway.
Yes.
I'm guessing that's the moment when everybody starts looking at each other in the audience and nodding, right? Because they know that moment.
Yeah, it is.
And there's no word for it. So if without a story, how do we know?
Right. Exactly. And my whole thing with story is that I'm not looking for stories of things that are so rare, so unique, so absurd that when people read it, they say, well, wasn't that odd? And that's the end of it. But I'm looking at things that are so almost profoundly common, so ordinary that when you hear it, you come to that moment when you say, ooh, I did that, or ooh, my cousin did that, or the neighbor did that, or it reminds me not necessarily of a haircut, but of a similar kind of thing that little fishhook of memory catches by hearing that story.
There's something really great about knowing that we all have that in common,
yeah.
I suppose. When you say the meaning of a story, could it be a meaning? Because don't those meanings change over time?
They do. They change over time with the person to whom things happen. But also, everybody listening draws different strings of meaning depending on what they've been through and what they've lived through and where they are at that moment. And that's why, you know, to come to the end of the story and say, now the moral is not workable, because you're shutting down the multiple rich meanings of a story. I can make a confessional statement and say, never again did I ever do so and so. But everybody listening may be saying, well, I did it again, or you know, I wouldn't have done it to start with. So I have to leave the door really standing open there at the end of the story.
You also teach workshops, and I wonder, do you know when you hear someone else's story that maybe the problem with it is they haven't given enough time?
The most typical thing that happens is that we remember one of those little days when something turned upside down. We remember that, and we think we've got a story. And we tell about that little thing, thinking we've told the whole story, and we've really just told a piece of it. And that's when somebody looks back and says, well, is that it? Or, I guess you had to be there. And what I have to help people do often is say, the story needs to start before that. It needs to start back when everything was normal, so we understand who it is who got turned upside down and how they got flipped over. So that, for example, because it's just fresh on our minds, we look in the paper at these tornado photographs. If we saw a picture of a destroyed house beside a picture of that house when it was perfect, it would be much more meaningful to us.
So you want to
see that?
We
would see the
first
contrast. And so in a story, I have to say, we have to start back before the trouble, so the trouble has real meaning. And you can't just stop with, I got in trouble.
Right.
We've got to push forward till we say, till we come to a never again, or from that time on, or the next day, then because there are three pieces of it, not just that middle part.
And then there's the art of artful digression.
Right, right.
Is that something that you got right away? Can you teach something like that?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we discover it more than we teach it. What I do in workshops often is help people play with their unorganized attic of memories. And what we do is, instead of looking for a story, we start looking for quilt scraps, for parts and pieces, parts and pieces, parts and pieces. So what we do is, in the beginning, we have all the digression materials. And what we begin to do is then thin down to what we need to make a particular quilt. Then we discover that, yes, it is nice often to lay little sort of false trails where people think it's going this way and then discover, no, it's really going this way. But often those are ornaments. And we have to understand the difference between what must be told and then the ornaments that we can hang on the story along the way if we have time to do that.
Are they just ornaments, or are they, in an odd way, related to the story, just not as obvious as
absolutely.
Think?
I mean, absolutely. But if I'm telling a story on live radio and the time's running out, I want to be able to drop that thing that I'm calling an ornament instead of the essential last step in the story.
What was the first story you ever told professionally?
The first stories I ever told professionally 30 plus years ago were retelling some of those family stories that I heard, but I had to explain who the people were and the places where things happened, because in the family, all you do is summarize the plot. Because you know the characters, you know the places. So about a third of the story was inherited and about two-thirds was mine. The first story I probably told that way was a story about my Uncle Frank's fox dog that ran off when they tore up the floor of an old barn, and under the floor were fox tracks that were there from before the barn was built. And what was a tall tale story, his dog took off following the scent of a fox that had come through 60 years ago. And 30 minutes later in the story, they find the fox in a used clothing store in Baltimore barking at an old fox fur coat. But there's 30 minutes of those digressions right. in between along the way.
And your stories generally are that long. We can't even have you tell
most of your stories. They're normally a half hour, 20 minute to half hour stories.
And you talked about having to set up your family so that you know who they are. And of course, when we're telling stories around the dinner table, everybody knows everybody.
Right.
But it doesn't take long before we start recognizing your Uncle Frank.
Exactly.
Because I've got one, too.
Oh, you do. Yeah. Uncle Frank and our family was the person in charge of bad ideas. And all you have to do is say that, and everybody is pointing to, you know, if they're with their family, they're all pointing toward, there's someone in their family who's in charge of bad ideas.
The one who always comes up just a little bit short, but boy, was that a good idea before you started. Do you work with kids to help them shape their stories? I mean, is there a time... Could a child be too young to be sort of intellectual about storytelling?
They have to be old enough to be linear in thought. And so my sense is once someone is a pretty strong reader, they're becoming then linear in thought progression, and we can really work with story. The biggest thing with kids is that we have this little kid gene in us, which makes us think that the place where we live is the dumbest, most boring place on the face of the earth, and the family we got stuck with is a boring family, and nothing ever happens to us, and we don't have any stories. And the biggest thing with kids is to help them discover that they do have stories, and that's why a story like the story about cutting my brother's hair really works well with kids, because if I tell that story, all I have to say is, anybody here ever try to cut someone's hair? Ever try to cut your own hair? Ever try to cut someone's doll's hair? Or give a pet a haircut, and their hands are all up, they're all ready. And it's much easier to shape something than it is to try to find what they don't think is there.
And you're talking about for teaching, because it's interesting
exactly.
that you would say you need to have learned to read a little bit before mm-hmm. you can be taught how to storytell. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would think, in fact, you don't write your stories down, do you?
There's no pattern. Yeah. It's like taking someone who's never heard music and say, let's write a song. It all comes out of modeling because those patterns are absorbed. And often when kids have trouble with stories, it's because they simply haven't heard enough stories to know what that means, mm. to know what is that. Yeah.
In your years of storytelling, have any of them had their meanings radically change over the telling of this?
They do change because the time changes. When I, 20 years ago, first put together and in my very first book had there was a Vietnam story there. At that time, if I would tell that story, essentially everyone in the audience had lived through Vietnam. If I tell that story now, people up through and beyond, wow, all the way up into their 40s have mm-hmm. no firsthand memory of that. And so the story not only has different meaning, the story has to be handled differently in terms of building the norm, because the norm is not there. It's not there for people who didn't live through a time period like that. And that's probably the easiest kind of example of that sort of thing.
On the State of Things Today, talking with professional storyteller Donald Davis. His new book is called Tales from a Free-Range Childhood. Coming up after a short break, why storytelling keeps Donald on the road 294 days of the year. And that's no tall tale. Stay with us on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Donald Davis. He's a professional storyteller, lives in Ocracoke, and he is the author of a new book, Tales from a Free-Range Childhood. And, of course, some of the most memorable stories we all live with are about the holidays.
Oh, yes.
You have several in the book, but yes. One in particular comes to mind about the your and Joe's desire for a sled for Christmas.
Oh, yes. We wanted a sled for Christmas so badly. When we were little, we lived in a sort of a creek bottom house where all the mountains went up. And so we never thought about a sled. And when I was 12, we moved to a new house, and we were on top of a hill. Plus, we had neighbors, Larry and Ronnie Leatherwood, our age. And about the first time we went to their house, there were sleds in their garage. And we begged and begged, and we got sleds for Christmas. And they took us out on the big hill to show us how to use them. It was a wonderful hill that had only one tree, an apple tree right in the center of it. So we could go down one side, walk up the other side, and we kept doing that. And in a little while, one of our little brothers needed to go to the bathroom. We tried to get them to go in the snow, and they wouldn't do it. They thought that was nasty. So they both then had to go, and they went inside Larry and Ronnie's house. And while they were gone, Larry and I got a great idea. Now, so sometimes I will ask kids if anybody in their family says I got a great idea, it always means that's a bad idea. So we took one of the sleds and we made tracks straight toward the apple tree. And when we got the sled right up at the apple tree, we lifted the sled over and we made a track go past the tree on one side, and then we made a single track go past the tree on the other side, and then we put the sled back down in those tracks below the tree. And we got on the sled, and when they came around the hill, just as they came over the top, we pushed off and went on down the hill yelling, "We did it, we did it, we did it, it tickled, it tickled." And they came and looked and said, "What did you do?" And we just pointed and said, "How did you ride through the tree?" And we told them, "You just had to close your eyes when you got there and just hit it right in the middle and you'd go right through." And we did not tell them to try it. It was their own idea. We just watched. So they came down the hill toward the tree, but Larry and I had a conscience attack, and we started screaming, "No, no," but it was too late. It was just in time to announce that it was our idea, and they did hit the tree. We didn't get in trouble, though, because they were somehow so embarrassed at being dumb, they didn't tell on us.
Hmm.
That's half the whole story. There's another whole half that comes later.
No,
it's the kind of thing we just couldn't keep from doing. It was because it was there.
Because you have to do it. Well, and how much do they feed on each other? The how does the storytelling itself feed the imagination of the child and then the adult to even come up with an idea like that? The idea that I can fool. And I'm going to take it one step further because I'd like to hear your take on this. Mm-hmm. The idea that I can fool you, that I can somehow create something that isn't true and then make you think it is.
And I think about that and I go back and look at that and I think, you know, that was so obvious in lots of ways. It was so obvious, and yet when they looked at it, they couldn't put it together, and they just had to do it. And it was almost like there must be some trick, and if they could do it, we must be able to do it too. it was just amazing to think of that.
Well, it's like that great scene in Huckleberry Finn, you know, where the Duke and the King realize that they fooled everybody and that they're going to get chased out of town. No, they're not going to get chased out of town because everybody's too embarrassed at being fooled.
Right, they're too embarrassed at being fooled.
At their
and a lot of times you could get away with something that way because one of the whole stories in the book is about my going shopping with my mother. And she's trying on clothes in a women's store called the Toggery, a place I hated to go because there was nothing to play with in there, while she would try on clothes that she already knew she wasn't going to buy. And as I was crawling up and down through the clothes, I came to a little skirt that had golf tees in the belt. And I knew that was a skirt for women who were going to play golf, and I played with the golf tees, and they came out, and somehow they ended up in my pocket, and I didn't know how they ended up there because I was 6 years old, and by then I forgot they were in my pocket. And that night my mother said, after you put on your pajamas, throw your dirty clothes out the door so I can start a wash. And she had this horrible habit of going through the pockets when that was a ridiculous thing to do. She should have just washed the clothes. So in a moment, the door of my room burst open, and she came in, and she asked one of these questions. You just, as a kid, you never understand why parents can ask such dumb questions. She held out the golf tees, and she said, "What do you call these?" And I thought, "Don't you know they're golf tees?" I finally had to confess. Well, she told me the man who owned the store was the lay leader at our church, Mr. Hugh Massey, that I had to go up and tell Mr. Massey what I did and apologize. And then somehow she realized that if I actually did that, she would be the one who was embarrassed because he would think her child was a thief. And so when I got the idea, why don't I just put them back and we won't say anything about it? Oh, it was the greatest idea I ever got in the whole world. But it really, you sort of learn that there are things that will embarrass your parents that you can manipulate to enable you to get away with certain things.
Do you start seeing stories sort of captioned in categories, the too embarrassed to tell the truth stories, the good idea, bad idea story?
Yes. Yeah. There's the time you got hurt because you did something profoundly stupid story. You know, there's the time you did something you thought you wanted to do, but you went too far and you had to pray your way back, you know, story. I'll never do that again. Get me out of here. I'll never do it again. There's the story you, no matter whether she's dead or alive, you still don't want your mother to know about, you know, story. They go on and on. There are loads of those things.
Has it ever happened to you that one of those stories jumped categories that you'd been telling?
Absolutely. And a lot of them cross categories. They cross categories. One of my stories is about a time you rode on a ride that you later wished you had never, ever gotten on. That's a whole category. But by the end of the story, it's a story about a time when something happened that made my mother change her mind. So they do, even in the course of a story, they take several steps along the way.
Can you tell us that one?
That story is a story about the most exciting thing in the world to me as a child was when the carnival rides came to the county fair. Because when you grow up in a little town, everything's a big deal. And we would beg to go to the rides, and I was scared of all the rides. I didn't want to ride anything. My mother would always say, "We don't know who put it together, so you can't ride on it. It might come apart." So the only thing we ever really rode was the merry-go-round. Till the year came when we were begging, and my daddy came up with a great idea. My mother should stay home and do what he calls something useful. And he would take us. And as soon as we took off with my dad, he said, "We've got it made now, boys. We can do whatever we want to do. We can even eat junk." Well, after we rode the merry-go-round about eight times, he said, "Let's try something else. Let's try the ride that wasn't here last year, which was called the octopus." Well, the octopus just about put me out of this world. And my little brother, who was not old enough for his brain to have come together yet, thought it was the greatest thing that ever happened. And all he would do is say, "I want to ride it again. I want to ride it again." Even though at the end, he ended up with, you know, green stuff coming up out of his nose like a yo-yo. So that's kind of, that sounds like it's the whole story. It sounds like it. But the story turns a corner when, back at home a few weeks later, my Aunt Etty comes to our house with two kittens. She wants us to hide for 2 weeks till our cousin Kay's birthday comes along. And my little brother Joe ends up being the one who's going to keep them because my mother hates cats. And he keeps them in the garage until one day we hear screaming, 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 and we run out of the house, and he's screaming, "They're dead, they're dead, they're dead," and the cats are on the ground. They're not dead, but they're kind of wallowing around, and they can't get up, and they keep falling over. And he says, I let them ride the octopus." And he picks up these two baskets that he has put the cats in and swirl them around to make an octopus ride for cats. And the little cats are so drunk, they're just falling on the ground. And my mother, who hated cats, immediately picked them up and held them up to her heart and petted them and went inside and called my Aunt Etty and said, "You have to get Kay some more cats because I love these and we're going to keep them." So it takes a real turn.
What an amazing story. Do you rehearse your stories?
Well, you can't really, yeah, because they're built over against the faces of listeners. And so in the beginning, I may need to just tell one person about a story that I think might work. And I may tell my wife Merle of that, or I may tell, you know, just a person in conversation. And their reactions, even just in that conversation, help me see, ooh, I need to tell a little more about this for them to get it. I don't need that part. Then you gradually move up. Maybe I'm working with a class of kids about writing, and I say, "Let me tell you a story that I'm not happy with yet, but let's see how it's going." And so I may tell them about it, and it gradually grows to the point at which I'm ready to bring it out and then put it between two stories that work well and see how it works, because I have to do it over against listeners. And as sure as I try to script something, those words are not going to be the words that work.
Have you ever tried to write fiction? And is storytelling part of the genealogy of fiction, do you think? The kind of storytelling you do.
It's very much part of the genealogy of fiction. I think if you read Mark Twain, most of the things you find in Huckleberry Finn are things that he and his brother and his friends did as children. The thing that makes it fiction is that he takes a what-if turn. You know, what if we took this corner and we went here? And the same thing is true over and over again with fiction writers. It starts with reality and takes the what-if jump. I just have never finished with all the stories that are there enough to go around that corner. The one exception was one book I did called 13 Miles from Suncrest, which is a novel that's essentially made out of stories I heard my daddy and his brothers and sisters tell when they were reliving their childhood. But once they were gone, I didn't know which one of them did what, and I didn't have a chronology. So I sort of create a family like their family and pop all those stories in there. So I didn't really create the stories, but it is a novel because I create the people and I and I establish the chronology and the framework and put it together in that way.
You think when you make that turn into the land of what if, you are working with a fundamentally different kind of storytelling, or is it essentially the same thing?
I don't think you really are, because what if has limits. And if you cross those limits, people read and think, that's absurd. Yeah. That's just absurd. And you learn those what-if limits playing with real stories.
Is there a fundamental difference between folk tales, the Jack tales and those sort of mm-hmm. stories that everybody tells, and our own personal stories and family stories? Yeah.
I think I learned a lot about my stories now from hearing a lot of traditional folk tales growing up, because the patterns are established there. The patterns are you meet a character and you find out what their world is like and who populates that world. And then one day something happens that turns a piece of their world upside down. And then you figure out what did they have to learn, or what kind of help did they have to get to overcome that and get out of it. Sometimes then what they learn is tested to see whether it's real. And that same path is taken in our own stories.
Wondering about your middle career as a minister mm-hmm. and your bracket careers as storytellers. Are they the same thing, or are they very different?
Much the same thing. They're very much, because they're all about stories of meaning. And if a story has no meaning, we're not going to listen to it twice. If it has no meaning for us, we're not going to come back to it as something we're really attached to. So I think they are very much like that. And a lot of the stories I tell now that are 30-minute stories had their birth as sort of 5-minute sermon illustrations in the beginning that then had the freedom to grow out into their full whole life in the world of storytelling.
So Tales from a Free-Range Childhood deal with your childhood. Will you be ready to tell the stories of your adulthood? And are you thinking about
that? I'm working on that. I'm up about to college now. I'm just about there. The real question about college stories is, if I call it fiction, I can tell what really happened to pretend I made it up. If I call it fact, I'm going to have to leave a lot of stuff out. Can't go there.
Or really check on the statute of limitations.
Right.
With a lot of those. Yeah. And is there anything about living on Ocracoke is that a storyteller's particular universe?
Well, living there is a lot like living in the mountains when I was a child, because the way of life is slow, the community is small, there's intimacy of community and neighbors. So the mountains where I grew up are in my mind, not in geography. So it's almost easier to be in another place and walk back there mentally than it is to be there now and see what's there that wasn't the same when I was growing up.
Donald, great pleasure to talk with you again. Thanks so much for being
on
the show. Donald Davis, a professional storyteller, author of the new book, Tales from a Free-Range Childhood. You can hear Donald read from that book tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Winston-Salem, tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble on Northline Avenue in Greensboro. Then on Wednesday, April 20th, 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And on Thursday, the 21st, 7 o'clock, Country Bookshop in Southern Pines. For more information about Donald Davis, check out ddavisstoryteller.com. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org. You can check us out on Facebook as well. The State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. William Kumpf and Nasser Abbas are our interns. Robin Copley is the technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.